The headlines: Iran removes two surveillance cameras of the International Atomic Energy Agency, saying their activity was beyond its commitments under the safeguards agreement. Iran's leader takes Arab governments to task for shaking hands of friendship with a Zionist enemy under pressure from the U.S. government. And a report says the Pentagon has failed to track civilian deaths in Yemen, even though they were caused by an array of deadly U.S.-made weapons. Our top story for this half hour: Iran says it has removed two surveillance cameras of the International Atomic Energy Agency from one of its nuclear sites. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran said the two cameras had been installed voluntarily and beyond the safeguards obligations of the IAEA. The organization said the IAEA has not only been ungrateful for Iran's extensive cooperation, but has also considered it as a duty. He said Iran has shown its goodwill by all-out cooperation with the nuclear watchdog. This, as an anti-Tehran resolution, will be put to vote at the upcoming meeting of the IAEA's Board of Governors. The draft, which was submitted by the U.S. and its three European allies, accuses Iran of insufficient cooperation. Iran has condemned the move. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran has no hidden or undocumented nuclear activities or undisclosed sites. Mohammad Islami says submission of an anti-Tehran draft is in line with a political move to maintain maximum pressure on Iran. Earlier, academic and geopolitical policy advisor Alexander Ozadegan joined us to give his perspective on an anti-Iran resolution the U.S. and its allies are pushing at the board meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Any little thing in Iran is going to be politicized, whether it was the train that got derailed from Mashhad to Yazd or the 10-story building collapsing. The enemies of Iran are going to politicize it. They're going to link it to the nuclear issue, and it's going to just go on from there and never stop. The bottom line is that sanctions are terror tools used by all imperialistic powers to destroy, sabotage, and implode the stability in other countries. It's economic terrorism is what we call it. The idea is to destroy the spirit of the people. Economic coercion. Iran's case going up the chain at the IAEA level, and the accusations are serious. Of course, Iranian military facilities are not obliged to be inspected, but that's exactly the point that they're trying to make. IAEA and also the politicization by United States and E3.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution hits out at the nexus between some Arab governments and the Israeli regime, saying the normalization deals would not benefit them at all. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says the ties with Israel would harm those Arab countries, as the regime's main motive is to exploit them. He underlined that Arab nations are also opposed to their governments inking the deals and shaking hands with the Israeli regime. Ayatollah Khamenei further said that such agreements were the outcome of constant U.S. pressures on those governments. Four Arab countries, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco, normalized their relations with Israel under U.S. brokered agreements in 2020. The move sparked an outcry in the Muslim world. Palestinians in particular denounced the normalization as a stab in their back. And staying with Iran, at least 17 are reported dead and dozens more wounded in a train derailment in a central city just hours ago. Reports say over a dozen of those wounded are in critical condition. The incident has happened near the desert city of Tabas in South Khorasan province on the rail linking it to the central city of Yazd. Rescue teams with ambulances and helicopters have been dispatched to the area, according to the initial reports. The train carrying nearly 350 passengers collided with an excavator. Further investigation is underway to find out the exact cause of the accident. New reports are indicating that the humanitarian crisis in war-torn Yemen is worsening. According to a report by the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, the number of people in need of humanitarian assistance has risen to more than 23 million over the past year. The report also says the number of Yemenis requiring food assistance has jumped over 17 million. It has cited the ongoing war continuing economic shocks and decreasing aid as the reasons. Another report by the International Monetary Fund says that rising food prices and inflation worldwide amid the Ukraine war have deteriorated the crisis in Yemen. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its allies, launched a war on Yemen in 2015. It has directly or indirectly claimed the lives of hundreds of thousands of Yemenis. The UN has already described Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian disaster. And for 7 years, the Saudi-led coalition has been using U.S.-made weapons to kill Yemenis, but American officials have failed to keep track of how many civilians have fallen victim to their deadly munitions. An internal U.S. government report blames that on the State Department and the Pentagon. The report also says they failed to assess the use of American-made weapons in the killings. The report has not been publicly released yet, and the State Department is apparently trying to classify some parts and redact a number of lines. The findings spanned three U.S. administrations since 2015 when the war started. The report is especially important considering that President Joe Biden is preparing to visit Saudi Arabia this summer. He's facing criticism for failing to deliver earlier promises to pressure the kingdom over its rights records and to cut the sales of offensive weapons used in the Yemen war.
When Saudi Arabia launched an air campaign on Yemen in March 2015, it assured the U.S. administration of President Barack Obama that it would oust the Ansarullah movement within months. But the war, aimed at restoring a former friendly government in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, dragged on with limited military gains. Under Obama, whose government had close bonds with Saudi Arabia, indiscriminate and disproportionate airstrikes continued on Yemen. Homes, markets, schools, hospitals, weddings, and funerals were targeted with U.S.-made weapons, including widely banned cluster munitions. An all-out Saudi blockade exacerbated Yemen's health and nutrition crises, and diseases like cholera began to spread like wildfire. And all those happened amid military and diplomatic support provided by the Obama administration. The U.S. also stood silent in 2016 when Saudi Arabia, through threats of cutting funds to the UN, finally forced the world body to drop it from its list of the worst offenders against children for its attacks on Yemeni kids. Obama lost all chances to stop the slaughter. Donald Trump followed in the footsteps of his predecessor in supporting Saudi Arabia and made his first trip as U.S. president to the Arab Kingdom. Hours after landing in the Saudi capital Riyadh on the 20th of May 2017, Trump sealed a $350 billion arms deal with King Salman, the largest in world history. The transaction included tanks, combat ships, missile defense systems, as well as radar, communications, and cybersecurity technology. 2 years later, the U.S. president vetoed a bipartisan resolution to force stop America's involvement in Yemen's bloodshed. Like Obama, Trump, too, missed all the chances to end the slaughter.
This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is now deploying a destroyer and fighter jets in the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. France also says it will give military support to the UAE to help it protect its airspace. The Biden administration is also planning to bring Yemen's Ansarullah movement back on a U.S. blacklist. Aid organizations warn that the move would prevent the delivery of critical humanitarian assistance to millions of innocent people and could have adverse humanitarian consequences.
It will have much effect on Yemeni civilians, because many UN agency and NGOs are working in Yemen. If the United States will continue, or if they will declare the Houthi as a terrorist group, this will have a huge and a bad effect on Yemeni civilians.
By sticking to warmongering policies, the current U.S. president is also missing on his chances to stop the war, a conflict that the UN says has already turned Yemen into the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
Russian and Ukrainian forces remain engaged in fierce fighting in Severodonetsk, a key city in eastern Luhansk province. Now the provincial governor says that Ukrainian troops may have to retreat to stronger positions in the city. Serhiy Gaidai says Russia is expected to step up its attacks on Severodonetsk, which has been turned into a key battleground. However, he stressed that the Ukrainian military will not give up. On Tuesday, the Russian defense minister claimed his troops have been in full control of residential areas in Severodonetsk. Sergei Shoigu's remarks came after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that his forces are outnumbered by more powerful Russian forces, but they still have a chance to fight back. Zelensky also said that Ukraine will continue the fight until it takes back all its territory, and that stalemate is not an option. Our correspondent Johnny Miller is following the situation on the ground in Ukraine's eastern Donbass region. He joined us earlier with an update on the ongoing battle between Ukrainian and Russian forces for the city of Severodonetsk.
Well, the Ukrainians are certainly putting up a very fierce resistance, but the Russians, who have air and artillery superiority, are certainly on the front foot, although it has taken them quite some time to take Severodonetsk. It looks like they're achieving that at the moment. But the vast majority of the Ukrainian army, even before the war started, was in this region, in the Donbass. For the last 8 years, the Ukrainian army has been fighting the separatists, which is where I am now in Donetsk. The front line is just on the edge of this city and going northward. So the majority of the Ukrainian army have always been based here, which is why you saw in the opening weeks of the war, Russia make huge territorial gains in the south, but why it's proving a lot harder here. But still, there's no doubt that Russia is going forward slowly but surely in order for them to take the Donbass region.
Elsewhere, hospitals across France were deeply impacted by strike from medical personnel. French public health used to be ranked the best in the world, but austerity measures have caused a sharp decrease in the quality of care. Rami Mazari has more from Paris.
With unions showing rare unity, hospitals were brought to a near halt across France due to a major strike. Since the Great Recession began, seemingly no group in France, other than the Yellow Vests, have protested more often than medical workers. France's healthcare system was ranked number one in the world as recently as the year 2000 by the United Nations. However, its quality has plummeted following over a decade of banker bailouts and austerity cuts. Neoliberal economics as applied to public healthcare has created too many complaints by medical workers to list. Frozen salaries, slashed budgets, overwork, closed hospitals, a lack of equipment, gutted morale, and much more. Thousands of medical workers who refused orders to get coronavirus vaccines haven't been reintegrated, even though corona restrictions have ended in France. And that has created even more labor problems.
When you don't replace workers who retire or quit, then you're going to have longer wait times for critical medical care and worsened medical care overall. It's just gotten harder and harder to work at a hospital every year. We now have so few personnel that it feels like every single day is a strike day.
The degraded service has been dramatic and a common topic across France for years. The healthcare system is used by everybody, so politicians haven't been able to limit the negative impact to just the lower classes.
After 5 years of Macron, our healthcare system is in a state of catastrophe. We're seeing more and more people die from a lack of treatment. We have the money inside France already. Just tax the rich and businesses. Go after tax evasion and stop focusing public policy on the richest 20% of society. If we do that, then we'll have good public services and good healthcare.
The first round of legislative elections are less than a week away. The strike is a black eye for President Emmanuel Macron, just as he's trying to preserve his absolute majority in Parliament, which is crucial for him to be able to force through more neoliberal austerity measures. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Well, the UN has issued a stark warning of multiple looming food crises in war-torn countries. In a new report, the world body also said Afghanistan is the new entry to the list of countries at highest alert facing catastrophic conditions. Rahmatullah Bawan reports from Kabul.
In a new report aimed at highlighting hunger hotspots, the UN bodies warned that Afghanistan is the new entry to the list of countries at highest alert facing catastrophic conditions. The report says, beside other causes, the ripple effects of the war in Ukraine, including rising prices, are adding to the difficulties of people to provide food.
Today, food prices are skyrocketing globally due to war in Ukraine and wheat and food exports crisis. Afghanistan, as an importing and dependent country, has received major impacts. Since we don't receive imported food or good, we witness a quick rise in prices and food scarcity. Now the prices of food items are doubled and few people can afford them.
At the same time, Afghan middle-class families are sliding into poverty and hunger, as unemployment has been on the rise. Some also say that they are struggling to make ends meet.
Unemployment and poverty have severely increased. Not only me, but all of the people have slided into poverty. Joblessness has harmed us all. Last year I was a construction worker, but today I can't provide some loaves of bread for my family as I am unemployed. We are unable to make ends meet. The prices of food items have already soared.
Advocates in the country express concern about Afghanistan's worsening situation, saying the West, especially the U.S., share a major role in world poor people suffering.
If we provide the percentage, the U.S. is 60-70% to blame for the ongoing crisis in Afghanistan, mainly due to their moves and mistakes. In addition, now the Ukraine war is affecting the Afghan economy, so who is prolonging the war in Ukraine? Prolonging the war might harm superpowers, but it definitely ruins the economy and lives of vulnerable people across the globe.
The UN Refugee Agency has also called for $3 billion in urgent aid to Afghanistan before winter to avert famine and death. Afghanistan is facing multiple humanitarian crises. Poverty and hunger, in particular, are taking their toll on millions of people in the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Well, that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyrdom has a long history among Muslim clerics. This is the speech of the leader of the Islamic Ummah on January 13, 2020, by Imam Khamenei, in a meeting with the officials of the Martyrs Who Were Clerics Commemoration Congress. A scholar of religion, a religious authority, and a top teacher in the Islamic seminaries, namely our magnanimous Imam, entered the field of jihad and carried out that great endeavor, which was unmatched throughout the history of Shiism, considering the results that were achieved. He was a scholar, a researcher, a jurisprudent, a scholar in the principles of religion, a sage, and a mystic. In other words, he was an outstanding person in terms of religious knowledge, was the top religious authority of his time, and the best one in comparison with many other periods in history. And he achieved the highest rank in this regard. Therefore, we should not have this image in our mind that if we want to be a scholar, a religious authority, a researcher, and a prominent teacher in Islamic seminaries, this requires that we withdraw from doing jihad and the area of jihad. This is not the case. Entering the area of jihad is our duty. We must do jihad.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There are different kinds of jihad. Sometimes it may happen that jihad in science takes precedence. There are many cases in which jihad in science takes precedence. Sometimes military jihad takes precedence. Sometimes jihad in politics takes precedence. And there are times when jihad in society takes precedence. In all these cases, our young Muslim clerics and scholars must feel a sense of responsibility and know that they are the first people to be addressed by these statements, because the first and foremost responsibility of Muslim clerics is to invite people to do good. This is what the prophets did. This is our first responsibility. And the best means for inviting to do good is through action. Action in the area of inviting to do good. Therefore, entrance into the area of jihad is a clear, definite responsibility for religious scholars and Muslim clerics.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
North Korea has fired 8 short-range ballistic missiles toward the sea off its east coast. South Korea says the missiles were fired from an area of the North Korean capital, Pyongyang. In recent weeks, North Korea has test-fired a range of ballistic missiles, including its largest intercontinental ballistic missile. The latest one comes just a day after South Korea and the United States wrapped up their first combined military drills involving an American aircraft carrier in more than 4 years. Pyongyang has frequently protested against Seoul and Washington's joint military exercises, calling them rehearsals for invasion, despite Washington's talk of diplomacy. The latest test marks the 18th time that North Korea has fired its missiles this year, including what the U.S. says was a failed intercontinental ballistic missile test on May 4th that exploded shortly after lunch. Last month, North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, said he would strengthen and develop his country's nuclear forces at the highest possible speed. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has failed to restart diplomatic talks with Pyongyang as tensions escalate. Former U.S. President Donald Trump attempted to court Pyongyang, but even though he met with the North Korean leader 3 times, he refused to relieve any of the sanctions in return for the several steps taken by Pyongyang toward denuclearization. That hampered further diplomacy between Pyongyang and Washington and prompted Kim to announce an end to a moratorium on the country's missile tests.
So it understands that a country that does not have a formidable arsenal can be subject to US attack because it's considered weak. So this is part of it. Well, if it wants to remain the hermit kingdom, it must look to be strong and unpredictable, and this is how it uses its military, the projection of its military force.
North Korea, which has been under rounds of crushing UN sanctions since 2006 over its nuclear and ballistic missile programs, has ramped up its missile launches this year. The sanctions have led to rising levels of poverty and food insecurity. Despite the acknowledged food insecurity in North Korea, however, the United Nations Humanitarian Response Plan does not include an appeal for assistance to North Korea. A UN World Food Program report in 2019 concluded that 11 million of North Korea's 25 million people were undernourished, and one of every 5 children were stunted from lack of adequate nutrition. Last month, China and Russia vetoed a U.S.-led push at the United Nations to toughen sanctions on North Korea over its renewed ballistic missile launches. China, the North's closest ally, and Russia, whose relations with the West have sharply deteriorated over its military operation in Ukraine, said they would have preferred a non-binding statement instead of a fresh resolution against Pyongyang. Beijing warned that sanctions would cause an escalation and humanitarian consequences for North Korea, which has been recently hit by COVID outbreak. Meanwhile, Russia said Washington is ignoring Pyongyang's appeals to stop hostile activity. During the past 16 years, the UN Security Council has steadily and unanimously ramped up sanctions to cut off funding for North Korea's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. Since 2017, when the Council last stepped up sanctions on Pyongyang, China and Russia have been trying to ease sanctions on humanitarian grounds.
Because it's a coercive power. It doesn't want to treat another country on equal or humane terms, because, I mean, it doesn't want to preserve the current leadership of North Korea. It wants regime change.
In particular, China's strategic overture to North Korea since the collapse of U.S.-North Korea diplomatic talks in 2019 has drawn the two countries closer. With tensions rising over the U.S.-China competition and a new South Korean conservative government that vows to take a harder line on North Korea and China, Beijing has more incentive to keep Pyongyang close.
Tehran has blasted the controversial visit by the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency to Israel. The IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, held talks with the Israeli regime's Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, in Tel Aviv, days after criticism of Iran's peaceful nuclear program. Iran's foreign ministry has warned of further erosion of the agency's credibility, while its Director General kept silent on Israel's secret nuclear arsenal. Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said this questions the IAEA's impartiality. Grossi's visit to Tel Aviv came in the backdrop of a report by the IAEA alleging that Iran has not clarified the presence of nuclear material at three sites. Khatibzadeh, pointing to the UN nuclear body's blatant double standards, said the world powers cannot overlook Israel's weapons program while indulging in rhetoric about Iran's peaceful atomic program. Israel has never signed up to the Non-Proliferation Treaty that aims to ensure civilian use of nuclear technology. Tel Aviv possesses the largest number of nuclear warheads in the region and has never allowed IAEA inspectors to scrutinize its nuclear sites. On the other hand, Iran, despite being a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, continues to reel under harsh sanctions for pursuing a peaceful nuclear program. Earlier this week, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett accused Iran of stealing classified documents from the IAEA and using them to deceive international inspectors nearly two decades ago. Iran rejected the allegations as outright lies. The International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors is scheduled to hold a meeting on Monday, with all eyes on the agency's latest report. The meeting is reportedly set to adopt an anti-Iran resolution drafted by Britain, France, Germany, and the United States to accuse the Islamic Republic of withholding cooperation with the agency. Israel backs the draft resolution to rebuke Iran by the IAEA Board of Governors. Tehran has warned against any unconstructive action at the upcoming meeting of the body, saying it will respond immediately and proportionately.
The right to resist this kind of bullying and coercion and sort of domination from the West, that right to resist is not allowed. You were never allowed to resist. And anything Iran does to preserve its independence is going to be labeled as dangerous and subversive somehow to the international order, and on and on and on.
Iran says the visit by the International Atomic Energy Agency's chief, Rafael Grossi, to Israel ahead of the meeting of the Board of Governors is in contradiction with the agency's principles of observing impartiality and maintaining its technical and professional status. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remarks in a phone call with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, while pointing to the destructive measures of the Zionist regime, which is the main culprit of illegal nuclear activities in the world. Amir Abdollahian censured the, quote, hasty and unconstructive move by the U.S. and the three European countries, namely Britain, France and Germany, in compiling a draft resolution at the IAEA. He said such behavior goes against diplomacy and will complicate the talks in Vienna to revive the 2015 deal between Iran and the world powers. He reiterated Iran's resolve to reach a good, strong, and lasting deal. Iran's foreign minister also said his country will immediately, effectively, and proportionately respond to any political move against Tehran at the International Atomic Energy Agency. Joseph Borrell, for his part, censured what he called some attempts to undermine the Vienna talks. He urged all the parties involved to continue the dialogue to change the current negative atmosphere pervading the IAEA. The Board of Governors meeting will come as a pause in the marathon negotiations to revive the 2015 Iran deal has entered its third month, with prospects described by Washington as tenuous at best. Tehran blames the U.S. and its three European allies, France, Britain and Germany, for failing to act constructively.
Tensions are once again rising in northern Syria as Turkey threatens to conduct a major military operation there. Ankara says it wants to establish a 30-kilometer safe zone along the Syrian border and push back terrorists. Turkey has long been fighting members of the People's Protection Units, YPG, a U.S.-backed Kurdish militia it deems a terrorist group. Since 2016, Turkey has carried out three major incursions inside the Syrian territory under the same pretext, the latest of which came in October 2019, which fell short of ending in creating the buffer zone Ankara was hoping for. In the meantime, Damascus has slammed the Turkish plan as an act of aggression and an extension of Ankara's policy of ethnic cleansing in the area.
Turkey has been notorious for smuggling oil and engaging in oil theft in Syria. It has been launching military operations into Syria. It is indeed shot down and killed Russian military members in Syria. So Turkey has ambitions to expand its political footprint and reconquer parts of Syria that it lost after World War I in the Sykes-Picot Act, which the French and the British carved up the Middle East after World War I.
Syria says the measures taken by Turkey have caused civilian casualties and done massive damage to public and private property, including critical infrastructure. Syria describes Turkey's offensive as a shameful act of aggression that has displaced dozens of families from their homes and villages. Russia has urged Turkey to refrain from launching an offensive into northern Syria, saying it could lead to a dangerous deterioration of the already difficult situation. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman said such a move would be a direct violation of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Maria Zakharova added that an incursion by Turkey could cause a further escalation of tensions in Syria. Iran's foreign ministry made a similar statement warning of humanitarian disasters and heightened tensions in the region. Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said, while the Islamic Republic understands Turkey's security concerns, the only way to alleviate those concerns is through dialogue and respect for bilateral agreements with neighbors. Turkey's face-off against the YPG would put Ankara in an uneasy position with the United States, which considers the Kurdish militia a major ally inside Syria. U.S. State Department on Tuesday said Washington condemns any escalation and supports the existing ceasefire lines in the area.
Well, the United States certainly has backed the Kurdish operations to carve up Syria, to carve up Iraq, to basically split, divide, and conquer that whole region into ethnic strife and competition. And that is one of the sore points between the U.S. and Turkey, is the Kurds, because Turkey sees them as an enemy to be destroyed, whereas the U.S. sees the Kurds as a pawn, as a tool to use in destabilizing Syria, President Bashar Assad, and create endless civil war and conflict there.
Russia, Iran, and Turkey are the guarantors of the Astana peace process and have been mediating peace negotiations between the Syrian government and the opposition since 2017. Any rifts between the three could derail the talks and damage any progress they have achieved.
This is the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. The Vienna-based agency is supposed to monitor compliance with the 1968 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The NPT has been described as the centerpiece of global efforts to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons, promote cooperation in the peaceful uses of nuclear energy, and to achieve the goal of nuclear disarmament. The IAEA is supposed to have technical and professional cooperation with NPT signatories away from politics. The Atomic Agency has had a high-profile role regarding Iran's nuclear energy program. In 2015, when Iran and the P5+1 struck a deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the IAEA was tasked with monitoring Iran's compliance with the terms of the agreement. In many of its reports over the past years, the agency has said that it has found no evidence of any diversion in Iran's nuclear program. As the fate of the faltering 2015 deal remains increasingly unclear, the technical role and supposed independence of the atomic watchdog are being tested. In a recent report, the IAEA said Iran's stockpile of enriched uranium had grown to more than 18 times the limit allowed in the 2015 agreement. The agency also said Iran has failed to answer its remaining questions. Tehran described the IAEA's latest statements as one-sided, saying that it fails to reflect Iran's extensive cooperation with the agency.
The International Atomic Energy Agency seems to be succumbing to the same sort of takeover that the United States and the Anglo-Zionist Empire has been doing to so many other international organizations, such as, for example, in athletics, for example, in economics with the World Economic Forum, for example. All these organizations, they seem to want to control them.
Meanwhile, reports say Western countries lobbied by Israel are planning to push the International Atomic Energy Agency to criticize Iran at its upcoming meeting of the Board of Governors. Back in March, Rafael Grossi, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, visited Iran. The IAEA and Iran announced at the end of the visit that they had agreed on an approach for resolving remaining bilateral issues. The visit came as representatives from Iran and the P4+1 were trying to find a way to move forward in their negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 deal. The talks are currently stalled, with Iran saying the United States is failing to make necessary political decisions. At this point, any stance by the Atomic Agency could have an important effect on the stalled talks. This week, Iran's top diplomat said Tehran and the agency's agreement in March was mutually satisfactory. He warned that political interference in the technical affairs of the agency is totally unconstructive. Amir Abdullahian's comments came ahead of a meeting of the IAEA's Board of Governors scheduled for June 6. Days left to the meeting, the IAEA chief has arrived in Israel after Tel Aviv released documents alleging Iran spied on the IAEA. Iran says Israel, which has refused to join the NPT and is believed to possess hundreds of nuclear warheads, hates the JCPOA and wants to derail the effort to revive it.
The problem with much of what the International Atomic Energy Agency has been doing is that it is trying to find excuses to really, I suppose, make out that the Iranian nuclear program is a military program. And one of the problems with the IAEA is they're not looking anywhere near as closely at the Israelis, who do have nuclear weapons. They tried to keep it secret, but Mordecai Vanunu blew the whistle in the Sunday Times here in Britain back in the 1980s and did a massive jail term for his, when he was kidnapped, actually, for his trouble. That they do have many nuclear weapons, probably something like 200, they say.
Reports say the United States and its Western allies, pushed by Israel, plan to pile pressure on Iran at the upcoming IAEA meeting. Tehran has warned that it would respond firmly and appropriately to any such move because Tehran has been cooperating based on the agreement reached in March. The fate of months of negotiations between Iran and the P4+1 seems to be at stake as a meeting of the IAEA Board of Governors draws close. Who would benefit from a possible collapse of the talks?
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام وقال عليه السلام في قوله تعالى إن الله يأمر بالعدل والإحسان العدل الإنصاف والإحسان التفضل
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, said about Allah saying in the Quran, chapter 16, verse 90, Verily, Allah enjoins justice, adl, and benevolence, ihsan. Here, adl means equidistribution, and ihsan means favor.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, in the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence, the first divinely appointed Imam, he speaks about the heart. And it's interesting, but when he talks about the heart, there are different aspects of this heart that the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, speaks about. In one such place, he talks about how if the heart abounds in blessings, has many blessings, is overwhelmed with blessings, then the heart will become like a megalomaniac. Or in other words, the heart will become tyrannical, the heart will become despotic, the heart will become hardened, and it will become strict and harsh. And so here, dear friends, we find that it is true. When we find that things are going our way and we find that there are so many blessings around us, there is a high likelihood that our heart will become tyrannical and despotic. And this is because when one has many blessings around them and they are endowed with many blessings,
then there comes this sort of arrogance and pride and this kind of superiority complex, which of course turns into tyranny and despotism and megalomania. But one way to be able to fix this kind of a situation and prevent the heart from becoming tyrannical is when you realize that you have been blessed with a certain blessing, first and foremost, recognize that this blessing and every blessing is ultimately sourced with the Almighty Allah. And of course, the second thing when it comes to blessings and an increase in blessings and in order to save the heart from becoming tyrannical is that one should, after realizing that Allah has blessed us with these blessings, we should thank Allah abundantly. And this is one way to prevent our heart from becoming tyrannical. For as Imam Ali alayhi salam says, if it abounds in blessings, it will face megalomania. Another beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRab English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاجعل نفسي مطمئنة بقدرك راضية بقضائك.
O Allah, let me be happy and satisfied with that which Thou considers good for me. Let me agree with that which Thou decides for me. Let me passionately remember Thee and invoke Thee. Let me be in love with Thy pure and sincere friends. Let me be well-liked and respected on the earth and in the heavens. Let me be unruffled and well-composed in the midst of misfortunes. Let me be gratefully thankful in prosperity. Let me be mindful of much and more bounties. Let me ardently desire for the heart-warming meeting with Thee, well-equipped with piety to gain my end on the day of requital. Let me follow into the footsteps of Thy representatives. Let me disassociate myself from the mannerism of Thy enemies. Let me pass my time in this world by praising and glorifying Thee.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi ta'ala wa barakatuh. The subject of imama has been a matter of discussion between Muslim scholars for centuries and continues until today. One of the core central beliefs in the school of Ahl al-Bayt is indeed divine appointment of individuals chosen by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to lead mankind, both in the matters of this world as well as attaining the best in the hereafter. This book is called Al-Alf